So just real briefly, Bob's going to talk about alcoholism and what's AA's solution. And I just want to very briefly talk about what may be on a lot of your minds. I know it's on Bob's mind, is the potluck lunch. So what we're going to do is Bob's going to talk, and when he finishes up, we're going to get the tables out, bring all the food out, put it on the tables, and then I'll make an announcement when it's time to eat. So please be patient and give us a few minutes to get all the stuff out. And, you know, just relax, have some coffee, go outside, whatever you need to do, and then we'll all eat together. So without further ado, Bob's going to start the second talk. Thank you.
I'm Bob, an alcoholic. I am in a trap I cannot spring. Abstinence is not very good for me. I have an abnormal reaction to it. I get restless, irritable, discontent, depressed, worried. I worry a lot. A lot. I worry about, I'm continually solving problems that haven't occurred yet. And I'm very good at it. Always trying to clear up the wreckage of my future. And I'm worn out. So abstinence doesn't sit well with me. And yet I can't drink. The only thing that has ever given me relief from me doesn't seem to give relief from me anymore. It has turned on me. And I don't know what to do. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous does not look like a solution when you're depressed and lonely and full of shame and remorse and you've burnt your life to the ground. AA looks like a nice bunch of people, but hardly what I need. And you can come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you can come to hundreds of them, and never hear the solution. Now, part of that is because I'm solution resistant, because the solution doesn't make sense to me. And you know, it's funny, it doesn't make sense to most of us. When you look at when you're in the middle of the despair of alcoholism, you look at the 12 steps. Nobody goes, oh yeah, that works. No, nobody goes that. It's like I need a set of steps. Like step one, make Bob's police record disappear. Step two, bring her back properly ashamed of herself. Step three, make my family realize how wrong they've been. Put me back in the will. Where's the step that give Bob $1,000 step would make worlds of difference in my life? But instead you have things like turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Oh, that's creepy. You mean the God that sees in the dark and judges me? You want me to turn my will, my life? I'd be better off turning it over to a drug dealer. I mean, God, that's not good. That's not good. And the amends step. Oh, that's just one you warm up to, isn't it? Or being in a meeting and some guy said, and we have to pay back every dime. And I went, are you kidding me? I thought, that's crazy. I'd never live long enough to pay everybody back. So the solution doesn't look like a solution. And then you can go to meetings where there's other solutions. Just don't drink no matter what. I do that. That's really good up until the point I drink. I guess I drink no matter what. I guess. Seem to. All the countless swearing to myself I never would again and did. On page 17, it talks about this hitting a bottom and this solution. And it's really, this is an interesting passage. It talks about the real thing that binds us in spiritual community here. Or as it refers to in the end of the book, the fellowship of the Spirit. that we are a fellowship in action behind a common purpose and a common ethic and a common set of principles. And in the middle of page 17, it says, we are like passengers of a great liner the moment after shipwreck, the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage, which is the bottom, worst part of the ship, from steerage to captain's table. In other words, it's the great leveler. There's no class system here, right? We are like that. And unlike the ships, the feelings of the ship's passengers, however, our joy and escape from disaster does not subside as we go our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us, and it is. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news. This book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I think there was a time in Alcoholics Anonymous when there was one common solution. It doesn't happen anymore. I don't know about Norfolk, Virginia, or Virginia Beach, but I know in Las Vegas and a lot of cities I've been to, you have different camps have risen up. There's about 15, 12 to 15 members of AA that evidently weren't getting enough attention and wrote workbooks on what Bill really meant. And groups have risen up around these workbooks, and they work the steps with the use of these workbooks, and they all have a sense of smug superiority. Like, we have the good dope and those people don't. Right? And it's a very disunifying, because a new person, do I go a step in ahead, a primary purpose, back to basics, spiritual awakenings, there's like all these different deals. But the only thing, the only common solution is this book. This is the unifying force in Alcoholics Anonymous. The problem is we have all these other things that have sprung up. And they're well-intentioned. And when I have a friend who, his home group studies AA out of a workbook. And I said, that's fine, but that's not AA. He said, it's almost identical. It's very close to the big book. Well, listen, I said to him, I'll give you that of all the workbooks, yours is probably the best. But if you can represent yourself as an AA group, then we have to be fair and across the board say that they're all AA. Now, which one does the new guy go to, right? What does he do? I travel a lot. I'm all over the world. I've been to meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is the common denominator. It's not just the suffering. It's not just that you can go to a meeting anywhere in the world and you will have a commonality of sickness and insanity and craziness and drinking and everything else, but we should have a common solution. That when I'm at a meeting in Spain or South America or Asia or Australia or England or Ireland, and someone's talking about the fourth step, everybody in the room should know that they mean those pages in the big book. And what they should know, oh, I know what you're talking about. The resentment you're talking about, this was our course, aren't you? You're talking about the prayer in there. We show them the same tolerance, pity, patience. Oh, you're talking about that, aren't you? We should all be on the same page with the same solution. That's not the case today. There's all different ways to do stuff here. And I think these well-intentioned workbooks that guys often produce and grandize themselves with, they'll go around, hey, I'm the guy with got my name on it. It's sort of not in the spirit of anonymity. I think that they're well, I will grant that they're well-intentioned, but I'll tell you something, I've observed, my sponsors talks about this also, they've become, and they weren't, I'm sure the intention was not to become a disunifying force in AA, but they have been. Because it splits us into camps, right? And the only thing that we have that we can, that's our commonality is in here. And a supplemental book that was written later to expand on some more points of identification about the 12 steps, the book, the 12 steps, and the 12 traditions. That is our common ground here. Egocentric, intellectually minded people are offended by constraints. The ego wants the freedom to do whatever the ego And all I can say to people like that is, how's that working for you? One of the great women in Alcoholics Anonymous in California, she died years ago, was named Winnie Law. And Winnie's got a story, is in the back of the big book, Freedom from Bondage. Winnie was a remarkable member of AA. She started, matter of fact, the first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that was ever started in a mental institution on the West Coast was started by her by accident. She had a girl she was sponsoring who relapsed and ended up in Camarillo State Mental Hospital, and she didn't know what to do. It was a locked ward, and she went up to see her, and she's sitting in the day room with all these patients sitting around, and their ex-sponsee or new sponsee sitting there and pathetic. She didn't know what to do, so she just said, what the hell? I'll tell her my story. She just started telling her story like you would at an AA meeting. You give your lead, right? And she noticed peripherally that all the patients were kind of moving in a little bit. She didn't pay much attention, just keeps telling her friend her story. She leaves that day, she comes back the next day, and the head nurse pulls her into the office and said, what did you do yesterday? I said, what do you mean? I didn't do anything. She said, you did something in the day room. Well, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. I told my friend the story, my personal story. She said, the patients were the best they've ever been. Could you come back and do that regularly? And that was the first meeting, and she brought Jack Prose, a friend of mine who's passed away with about 60 years, and all these other people she brought in from AA, and they just started the first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in a state mental hospital in California that way. But Winnie says something, the point being, Winnie says something in her story that is remarkable, and yet my ego resists it. She says that real freedom comes from doing what you ought to do because you want to do it. I have a guy sponsor, he says, you have to surrender enough to make this your idea. And we talk in this, in step 11, It says that the proper use of will, and you can't jettison will, you can't jettison ego, but the proper use of it is to align it. It's in an aligning with God's will. It's doing what your internal compass knows you should do anyway. Not this, but in here. Most of us, we go in here, we don't come up with anything because we're blocked from in here. We're asleep. I've walked through life listening to the chatter in my head that scares me into taking action so much and scares me into having puffed up intellectual positions in life. It scares me into being selfish and self-centered and self-concerned and self-obsessed. Because fear is the muscle of the ego. If your ego wants you to lie to somebody, it's got to scare you. It's got to convince you have to. It's got to scare you with the confrontation. It's got to scare you with the feeling of rejection if you don't lie to them. You can't tell them the truth. It'll scare you. And you'll compromise your own internal, because you know, you're not stupid. You got that thing, and so you know that you really shouldn't lie to this guy. But you will if your ego can scare you. It's got to spook you. And it does. It's the muscle of the ego. It's its way of maneuvering me. So we have a common solution. It's outlined in this book. And without it, guys like me perish in the rooms. You can die in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a guy who's now 30, he's 36 years sober. He's a vibrant member of my home group. When he was 23 and a half years sober, he made the decision to take his own life. He had came to Alcoholics Anonymous 23 years before, and he did a little bit of stuff in the steps and prayed a little bit, and he got relieved of the obsession to drink, but not the obsession with himself. And 23 years later, he's so angst up and depressed and angry and lonely, because self will push everybody away eventually. You run your life on self. Well, Father Martin said it best. He said you can always find the untreated alcoholics. He said, look for the people at work that everybody walks on eggshells around. Look for the person that looks smugly superior yet doesn't really fit anywhere. Look for that guy. And he was totally alone. He had no friends left. He was depressed. He was full of fear. He hated everybody is wrong except him. He wants to kill himself. Well, in thinking about killing himself, the obsession to drink came back, which I understand. I mean, if you're going to kill yourself, you need some little bit of anesthetic to make the transition. I mean, that would make sense to me. You don't want to do it sober. It might hurt. So, and when the obsession, when he started obsessing and realizing he was going to lose his sobriety, it was the only flag of self he could wave. He was 23 years sober. He didn't mind dying. He just didn't want the people in AA to realize that he didn't have 23 years after he died, right? And so his ego, even his ego, was put to good use. And so he comes and he's a mess. He's a mess. And he asked me to work with him. He said, would you help me? And I said, yeah, Jerry, I'd love to. I said, we're going to start. I told him something. I said, you know, he's telling me all this stuff. And he says, what's wrong with me? I said, there's only one thing wrong with you, Jer. Only one thing? But all this, what's that? And I said, it's untreated alcoholism. That's all. And I said, give me a year of your life. Give me a year. But give me the whole year. And I want all of you. Like it says in the book, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely, which is more than half, completely give themselves to this. I want all of you for a year. And he said, okay. And we started through the steps. The problem that he fought and I fought with, helped him fight, is that he had 23 years of being right. His ego was dug in. I mean, it's killing him, but it's dug in. And he's a bright guy, so he's got all the intellectual superiority. You know, he's got all that stuff. He's dying. I had to keep reminding him. So, but you don't want to write the inventory. Well, you could always shoot yourself. I mean, he'd hate it. I'd remind him of that, right? That bring him back to the truth of his condition. And he got through it. And he started to change. His spirit started coming alive. When I met, 23 years sober, people avoided him. He put off such bad vibes that he'd come into a meeting and sit somewhere. No one would even sit around him, you know? It's not that right. You know what they call him? He's an active member. They call him Sweet Jerry. That's wonderful. He's sweet because he's so sweet. Everybody loves him now. He's been transformed. And I didn't do that. AA didn't do that. AA is the vehicle for God to do that. That's where the power is. And I passed on to him what had been passed on to me from people who had been passed on to them. And that's what we are tasked to do here. It's part, it's not only part of the solution, it's really the big piece. You know, we have this saying, you can't keep it unless you give it away. I'll tell you something, I don't even think you get it until you give it away. It's the Hindus have a saying that the student doesn't learn the lesson until he becomes the teacher. And I think that's really true. We get it as we give it away. So what is the problem? Well, the book says lack of power. That is our dilemma. Spiritual growth is a process of self-abandonment. It's not a process of acquisition of knowledge. See, that's one of the reasons I took all those classes and I got into the counseling field. I was so enthralled with psychotherapy. My mother was a therapist. I mean, I grew up around that stuff. Because my ego thinks I can grow by acquisition. You grow from subtraction. You grow by becoming less. Really and truly, less is more in the realm of the spirit. All this, Alcoholics Anonymous is a funny place. We all come in as big shots and work our way up to servant. Right? We're all the I know people, you know, the I know people. And then as time gets on, you just want, you know less and help more. When you first get sober, you help none and know everything. So I grow in self-reduction or self-abandonment in service. Because the problem is that there's too much of me between me and God. Just as there's too much of me between me and you. Alcoholism is such a lonely, lonely business. When you're fully yourself, you're alone. There's no community. The ego exists in a state of separation. The Hindus tell us, Buddhism came from Hinduism. It's probably the oldest spirit. I have some friends that are Hindus from India, and they say, and I think this is true to some extent, and the same is true for Buddhism. It's not really a religion. It's a way of life. That's why, with Buddhism especially, because when the Jesuits first went to Asia and they started carrying missions out there, a lot of them were coming back enthralled with Buddhist exercises. And the church got very upset. Oh, this is, you're heathens. And they kept saying, the Jesuits kept saying, no, you don't understand. Buddhism makes us better Catholics. Right? It's not a religion. Well, it looks like a religion. It's not a religion. It's a practice. And the Hindus tell a story of creation that is remarkable in the light of my own spiritual experience and that of most of us. They say, unlike the Judeo-Christian version of in Genesis, their version of creation is that God existed unto himself. He was everything. And he devised this cosmic game. He broke himself up into an infinite number of parts and gave all the parts amnesia, that they don't know that they're really God. And the game is, let's see which parts awaken to the truth that they are not separate from the other parts and they are not separate from God. They are one with. And the Hindus say that that is enlightenment. When you wake up to the great reality that you, I am you. And Alcoholics Anonymous really facilitates this. If you sponsor a lot of people and you do what it says in the book and you listen, take them through the steps and you listen to fifth steps, after about 20 or 30 fifth steps, you start getting it. It's the same person every time. It's the same. I got a guy now, he's working on his fourth step. We're probably in the next, before I go to Spain, we're probably going to do his fifth step in the next 2 weeks, I imagine. And, you know, I'm always hopeful that it'll be something interesting and exciting. And, you know, like, oh, a Shetland pony, a gallon of peanut butter, and a vibrating lawn rake. You know, something, you know, but it's never like that. It's always the same insecure, scared, vacant person desperately trying to fill his own vacancies and gratify himself and stepping on the toes of everyone around him in the process and burning his life down and standing there feeling like a victim. And he did it. That's the same story. The details, minor details are different. So you had a goat, you had a chicken. I mean, you know, little minor detail. I said to one guy one time, he's writing his he's finishing his fourth step. He's really uncomfortable about taking his fifth step. And I was kidding. And I said to him, I said, listen, there's only so many barnyard animals. And he looks at me like this with his hard look, and I thought, oh, I hit a nerve. I'm sorry. It's okay. Whatever's on there is fine. It's fine. Really. It's fine. Well, because you start waking up, as you start to see yourself, anything that you ever will hear of in a fifth step or a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that did, no matter how horrific it is, if you're awake, then you know something. You know that if you had been hurt like that person was hurt, if you were vacant like that person was vacant, if you were afraid like they were afraid, if you were selfish like they were selfish, if you were sick like they were sick, there's a high probability that you could have done what they did. See, the fact that you didn't do it doesn't make you superior. It's a matter of circumstances rather than virtue. That I am not superior. The ego loves to judge because it puffs itself up with a feeling of smug superiority. But the truth is, in the awakening, is I know that I am you. Einstein said it wonderfully. He said that the great illusion of mankind was that there's more than one of us here. That we are all the same. We dress it up, and the ego battles for its uniqueness. My sponsor has a banner in his garage on the wall that somebody gave him from a talk he gave one time. And he says that if alcoholics could rally under one banner, it would be this banner. And the banner says, "You don't understand, my case is different." We are common in our feelings of uniqueness. Don't you hate that? I want to distinguish, and here's the key word, myself. But I am not any different than you. It's funny, we battle for uniqueness and complain of loneliness. Alcoholics are the only people I know of that will treat loneliness with isolation. or we'll treat it by finding things wrong with everybody around us until we really are alone. So there's a solution. The book starts out in We Agnostics with talking about two things that are necessary for step two. And they're very small little things, and yet they're very difficult for those of us that come here egocentric. That's why we have to be beaten into a state of reasonableness in order to take these actions. And it's on page 46, it says the two things. It says, first, we found that as soon as we were able to first lay aside prejudice. Well, prejudice comes from the Latin, and it just means all our judgments, all our preconceived notions, all our opinions. It's our perceptions. It's everything the ego judges is to be so. Well, and the problem is, if you're egocentric, you don't know that those are prejudices. Those aren't prejudices. That's not a prejudice. That's really the way it is. Because the ego is hell-bent on being right. It doesn't care how miserable you are. It doesn't care if you can't sleep. It doesn't care if you feel horrible. It doesn't care if you die, as long as it's right. It That's all it cares about, being right. So a lot of my prejudices, I didn't recognize as prejudice. And some of them are unconscious, and yet they dominate me and drive me as much as conscious ideas. Maybe more, probably more. What are your prejudices about? What are the things that make surrender to God impossible or difficult? One of the prejudices that I had, and I found this to be so common with us, it was an unconscious yet driving force in my life, and it was an unconscious idea that at one of my worst moments, one of those moments where you've just caved and you did something that you hate yourself for. Maybe you were newly sober and you were irritable and you were having a really bad day and you just flipped out and you beat one of your kids. Oh, you hate yourself. You hate yourself. You can't get the look of shock and terror in their eyes out of your mind. Or maybe after a spiritually vacant period of time, you caved. Someone was flirting with you, and you caved, and you felt so, and you ended up sleeping with someone that you shouldn't, and you're married. And you hate, oh my God, you just violated every principle. Oh, you swore. You hate people that would do that. So you end up feeling about yourself the way you feel about someone else that would do that. On those moments where you've just done something where you despise yourself, the prejudice is an unconscious feeling that surely now God can't love me. Surely now God's not there for me. It's not even conscious. But what happens if that deep-seated idea, God does not pull away from me. The problem is because of that old idea, I will turn from the light. The light, God loves me, but I will turn from the light in my judgment of my own unworthiness. And the sad part about that, the deadly part about that, is that there's never a time in your life you will need God more. Never. You'll never need God more than in one of those times. And we all got feet of clay. I don't think nobody's going to stay sober a lifetime without having a day or two of screwing up. I mean, matter of fact, some of our great usefulness comes from it. You know, it's my mistakes that seem to help the people I sponsor. They're not real crazy about my success. The fact that I got a 12-cylinder Mercedes and a big house, and they just kind of hate me for that stuff. But the bad relationships and the stupid mistakes, oh, they just love that. Because we make a connection in our fallibility, in our imperfection. AA is very different from a lot of churches. Most churches, it seems, that if you're a sinner, they love sinners. They want you to come in and join their church. But then after you're there, they kind of want you to quit sinning. It's sort of implied in the brochure. But we don't do that in AA. Oh, not at all. Matter of fact, we go out to coffee and talk about people. You know what so-and-so is doing? Oh, yeah. You know, if he lives through this, he's going to help a lot of people. That's really true. I mean, it's really... There's a power here. There's a power here that is so magnificent, it'll take the worst of you and make it useful. Where else can you get that? Oh my God, you mean even the things I'm the most ashamed of in my past become such important assets in helping others? Who would have thought? Who would have thought to take to the graves things I was so ashamed of would become so useful in my life? They have. Not my successes, but my failures. See, there's a tremendous amount of mercy here. Thank God. I don't want justice. I've had enough. Thank you. I need mercy. I need mercy. So if I can lay aside my prejudices and really become childlike, this is an exercise towards humility. To get to a place to know the most important thing you would ever know is that you don't know. That is what the Buddhists consider real true enlightenment, is enough self-reduction to know you don't know. They have story after story that they tell about the simplicity of not knowing and almost being a blank, open vessel to God's grace. So we become childlike. And when we become childlike and you know nothing, you can receive a lot. God deplores a vacuum. He fills up all empty vessels. The problem is, if you're really full of yourself, you don't get much God. There's too much of you in the way. So we lay aside our prejudice, we become childlike. And the second thing it says to do is to express even a willingness. You don't have to believe in God. It's perfectly all right. And they told me that when I was new. They said, we want you to start acting as if God exists. Why don't really believe in God? Oh, that's fine. People here are very strange. And they said, we want you to physically get down on your knees and ask whatever's running the universe for help. And the first time I did it, I went back to the guy. I said, I don't really believe in God. I feel kind of like a hypocrite doing that. He said, you know what he said to me? He said, oh, hey, you've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Just do it. And he was right. I've been a hypocrite all myself. When you run your life on self, you'll promise a lot and never deliver because you only do what you want to do. Right? You can't be trusted if you're living a life on self, because you can promise, oh, I'm going to come over and help you with that. And then when the time comes, I don't feel like it. You won't go. You're a hypocrite. So they said, just start praying. And I started praying. And it was amazing. There's a line in We Agnostics that is so, the first time it really hit me at a gut level, it brought tears to my eyes in my sense of unworthiness. It says that God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. I don't really deserve his help, not after all the things I've done. And it didn't matter. All I had to do was start taking the actions and positioning myself in life as if he existed. And it was almost from the positioning he seemed to materialize and become real. From the moment I started praying, and they told me things like, you get in trouble any throughout the day, stop. Ask God for help. Well, I'm stopping and asking something I don't believe in for help. But I took the actions, and God started showing up. From the moment I turned my consciousness towards him, he started becoming active in my life. And I went through what everybody goes through. I started experiencing those coincidences. You know, the crazy little things. Like, I'd be sinking into a depression, and somebody in my home group can't get a hold of their sponsor, picks my name off the phone list and calls me at the exact moment when I don't have it in me to call somebody, and they call me because they need help. I needed more help in that moment than they did, and I couldn't ask for it, and they called me. Went to work one day. Well, got into work and my boss disrespected me. And I'm sober long enough to have enough self-esteem to be dangerous. And you can't treat me like that. See, I've been sober. The ego, as the ego returns, it returns with a sense of entitlement. And you get your rights back. That is a bad. You start saying things to, you want to know you're ego-driven? You'll say things to yourself like, it's the principle of the thing. That should be written over the gates of hell. It's the principle of the thing. It's the principle of the thing. You don't treat me. I'm sober. You don't treat me. You don't disrespect me like that. And I tell you, I wanted to punch him, but he was an ex-Golden Gloves champion. And I'm angry. I'm not stupid. And he disrespects me and leaves. Goes off on some appointments. And I'm there all morning. I'm grinding away. You know how you just have those conversations in your head with people that aren't in the room? You know, I just grinding away. Finally, lunch break's coming up, and this thought came into me from down in here. It wasn't from the chatter. It was just a feeling that I need to go to that noon meeting rather than go down to the lunch counter. I took my lunch hour, ran out to my car, raced across town, and went into a noon meeting that I don't normally go to. And by the time I settle into the chair and I actually show up, you know, because you just come rushing into a meeting, you're not there for about a minute or two. You know what I mean? You're just until you kind of settle in, and all of a sudden I can listen. And about the time I can listen, a stranger starts talking about an incident that happened on his job where his boss had asked him to do something, and he was too enthralled with doing what he wanted to do, and he didn't do it, and then his boss jumped him about it and hurt his feelings. And he gave his boss a line of crap, and he went to his sponsor. He said, "I'm going to quit my job." And his sponsor said, "Quit your job. Your boss was right. You were wrong. You need to go make amends to your boss." And I'm sitting there, and it was spooky, because that's exactly what had happened to me. It was spooky. And I realized I got to go back and make amends to my boss. The night before, he asked me to take care of something. And I was too wrapped up in myself. I was in a hurry to go meet my buddies at the Denny's before the meeting, and I didn't want to do it. And I sloughed it off. And then I came in the morning, and he confronted me with it, and I don't take criticism well. So I gave him a bunch of excuses. And he didn't want excuses. He wanted it done, and he jumped me, which really I got aggravated when I gave him excuses. And he was right. He's my boss. And I went back and I made amends to him, and he put his arm around my shoulder and he said, "Hey kid, we all make mistakes." And he told me a story about the mistake he'd made when he first got into that business. And this is the job I want to quit. All of a sudden it became a really nice place to work. What the question that begs to be asked, who's the choreographer? Right? I never had luck like that before. From the moment I started as acting as if God existed, he started to exist. You know something? I think we get to be right here by our actions. If you want to come in here and you want to take a position because you're sure that there is no God and there is no spiritual help and life is just a bitch and it's not going to ever be fair, I think you're going to get to be right about that. I think we make our own heaven and we make our own hell. If you come here and you surrender the ego and you start showing up in your life as if there's a power here that absolutely loves you, it is going to facilitate everything you need in your life. You're going to get to be right about that also. Wilson said something that I think... Wilson says stuff that I don't know if he's trying to be funny, but he says some things I think are hilarious. One of the things he says in the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, he said, "We've been talking to you a lot," towards the end of Step 12, he said, "We've been talking to you a lot about problems." Boy, you go to a discussion meetings, you'll think AA, that's all AA is. You'll hear a lot of problem, no solution. My home group is all solution, no problem. You take your problems to your sponsor, you come to our groups to hear their steps and to hear the answer. And he said, where was I? I just lost my track. Help me out. Where was
Wilson.
Wilson. Wilson said, we talk a lot about problems. And then he says, why? He says, well, that's because we're problem people. Boy, isn't that true. Did you ever see that movie Sixth Sense where that little kid walks around and says, "I see dead people. I see problems. Oh, yeah. I see them everywhere I look. I can walk into a room of people and I can just tell by your body language you're thinking shit about me, aren't you?" I can tell. I can read minds. I know what my boss is thinking. And it's not good. I see problems everywhere. I'm a problem person. I don't walk into a room and just see the good in everything and everybody. I've never had that experience. I'd have to be really high on something to have that happen. But I'll walk in and I'll see threat. I do instant threat assessments. Instantaneous threat. Because I got to, my ego is defended. And it's right, and it's problematic, and it has to have fear to exist. See, what if there wasn't any problems? What if this life of turmoil and pain really was paradise, and it wasn't, the problems I imagine don't really exist? What if everything was perfect? The only thing that's out of sync is me. What if everything was perfect? See, the problem is, if that's true, my ego fades into obscurity, because it has to have problems to exist. Without problems, it has nothing to play God over. It has nothing to run the show about. If God really was in charge and everything is in divine order, the ego hates that, because it feels it recesses into uselessness. It won't exist until it finds problems. So it's a problem seeker and a problem imaginer. I sponsored a guy for several years, and when he was about a year sober, he came to me and he said something. I think it was one of the funniest things I ever heard. He said, "You know, you're always bad rapping this worry thing. You know, I shouldn't worry. God's got it all wired. I shouldn't worry. He said, "Listen, I've realized that nothing I've ever worried about's ever come true. I think worrying works." What do you say to that? I mean, how do you respond? I just laughed. I didn't know what to say to him. You're an idiot. That's what I thought. I don't know. Worrying works. That's funny. But in the fear inventory, one of the things that it says in there is that my ego gets me scared. And then it says that those fears will set in motion trains of circumstance which are going to bring me misfortune that I don't feel like I deserve. I don't understand the cause and effect. I don't understand that I've positioned myself in the universe to make the fears come true. Psychiatrists call them self-fulfilled prophecies. I've had a life of that, where I go to work somewhere and I'm afraid the people there don't like me. So the fear repositions me subtly. I'm not even conscious of it, to the point where people start walking on eggshells around me, right? Because I'm on the defensive, because I'm worried about what they think. So did you ever have the experience of imagining that someone doesn't like you in AA? And then so you start positioning yourself to them as if they don't like you. You do that for a while, I'm telling you, they're eventually not going to like you. I mean, it's just, and what's it say? We are the producers of confusion rather than harmony. Our misery is of our own making. It arises out of ourselves. And then I love this line. It says, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Why do they have to say that? Why can't they be nice? Why can't they say, "Bob, you know, sometimes, a little bit"? No, they say, "Bob, here's the rest of the world on a level of self-centeredness. You're off the charts." And we really are. And we don't think so. I've never been in the middle of a self-will binge of judgment and self, where I think I'm self-will run riot. It seems normal to me. Silkworth says something brilliant. He says, to us, our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And that's goes way beyond drinking, into sobriety. I just adjust as if my mind has to maintain its integrity, and neural integrity has to twist itself around and have chatter inside to make whatever I'm doing, no matter how bizarre it is, seem normal to me. but I am bodily and mentally different from my fellows. I am my daughter is not alcoholic. My daughter is, and my sister both are very well-adjusted people. My daughter is, if you had to ask me for an example of someone I thought was spiritually autonomous and fit and healthy, I would point to my daughter. She's a natural altruistic person. She's other-centered. She has an intense moral compass that she would never violate. She just, what would you do that for, Dad? You'd feel bad. Oh, you got to push through the feeling bad. I mean, you know, don't let a little feeling bad stop you. Hey, listen, 30 seconds of gratification and 6 months of feeling bad is a good deal to a guy like me. You know what I mean? But my daughter is not an extreme example of self will run riot. A couple of years ago, she was... And I just adore my daughter. She's just the light of my life. A couple of years ago, she was ending a relationship. And I'm her dad. I love her. So I get together with her, and she's telling me about this, how this relationship and the end of it and everything. And I'm trying to be consoling, and I love her. I'd do anything for her. So I'm trying to say daddy-esque things to her, like, well, you got to kiss a lot of frogs to find a prince. I don't know what I'm saying. You know, I'm just trying to say stuff to help her out. I want her to feel better. And so I go home that night. She has her own house. She goes home. And next week, well, not quite a week later, we get together for dinner. And I'm excited to see her because I know she's going through a tough time. I want to be her dad. I want to be helpful. I called her up several times during the week, just left her messages at work. And get together in this restaurant. I sit down. I said, Kate, how you doing? She said, I'm doing good, Dad. I said, well, you know, with the breakup, how you doing? Because she opens up to me pretty good. She's never hid nothing from me. She says, oh, Dad, I'm doing all right. You know, I've moved on. I'm actually going out with some guy next week. You know, you can't just wallow around in that stuff. You got to move on in your life. And I'm looking at her like... I almost asked her to sponsor me. She thinks I'm funny because I said to her, I said, Kate, you couldn't have possibly got enough mileage out of that yet. I mean, I would have made my sponsors eyes glaze over. I would have taken hostage at least 10 AA meetings, you know. I would have gotten to the point where people wouldn't call on me in a meeting no more because I'm going to talk about that, you know. Right? But see, I'm an extreme example of what self wants. A self will run riot. My daughter's not. She's not willing to drink of that. Like, see, I drink of that stuff like I drank whiskey. I'm not a social feeler. I take it to the wall. And my daughter's not like that. And so I have this... problem is that I'm so full of myself. I'm an extreme example of self-will run, right? Though you don't think so. And you're asking me to start showing up. You're asking me to enter into a set of actions and starting with step three and this vital decision and then to follow through with the rest of the actions in order to facilitate a shift of getting my life out of the hands of the idiot. A shift. That I cannot do it on my own. You know, if you could, we wouldn't need steps 4 through 12. If you could actually carry, if you had it in you, the ability to carry out the decision in step 3, you'd just do that. The problem is that we're blocked. The problem is I have to enter into an intensive process of self-reduction and service to get enough of me out of the way to access the power. I can't without these actions. Alcoholics for thousands of years have known that the answer is God and have died and drank themselves to death knowing that God's the answer and begging God for help and not getting the help because there's no room in their life for his grace because they're too full of themselves. Faith isn't enough. William James knew that. Everybody's known that. Carl Jung knew that. Carl Jung said to Roland Hazard, when he told Roland, "You're screwed." And Roland said, "Isn't there anything I can do?" And he said, "Well, there's been rare cases throughout history of people having these spiritual experiences." And Roland got excited because his family was so, they had deep pockets. They had contributed so much money to this big cathedral. They had their own row, front row, had plaque on it. It was their row. And they were all very influential in the board of the church and everything. And he thought, "Man, I'm a shoe-in for that. I'll just go get involved with my church." And Young told him the truth. He said, "Even though that may be good, it will hardly provide the vital spiritual experience that you're going to need to overcome this terminal illness." And that's true. Alcoholics have been praying for years and dying of alcoholism. I did a workshop on step two one time, and I just, for a fluke, I asked for a show of hands. How many people in here have had a born-again experience and then drank after that experience? And about a third of the people raised their hand. The problem is I'm blocked from God. Even in moments of severe collapse, when I am just had tremendous surrender and self-reduction, these epiphany conversion experiences, if not followed up by more action, what happens is the ego grows back and shuts the light off. What I am by nature, because of the chronic spiritual nature of this malady, I'm like the back of a toilet tank. You can flush it, and I just empty out of me, and then just start filling up with me again. It doesn't make you a bad person. You're not even doing it consciously. You don't even know you're doing it. We are become self-extreme examples, and we don't think so. When I'm filling up with me, I don't think I'm filling up with me. But I'm filling up with me. And so I enter into this process in steps 3 through 9 that's designed to reduce me enough to start accessing grace. And it's odd that the results of third step or the promises of step 3 doesn't say at that point. You'd think it would. You've made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. That's pretty amazing. You'd think at that point you would have the nearness of your Creator. You'd think at that point you'd begin to have a spiritual experience. But no, it's not until after you've done step 5 that it says we've begun to have a spiritual experience. Because up until you start doing the cleaning house, you're not going to have a spiritual experience. You can have great intention. As most of us did. I said the third step prayer on my knees with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous at a little less than a year sober, and I started saying the third step prayer on my knees every morning, and I'm telling you, I'd get up off my knees and go out in the world and play God. And I had intention to carry out the decision in step 3. I just didn't have the ability. We were talking about this in the car the other day. One of my great Ronnie White stories. He's a comedian. He talks about getting a DUI. He was really, really drunk. And he said the cop arrested him and gave him the right to remain silent. He said he just didn't give me the ability. Right. See, you gave me the third step prayer, but in the prayer doesn't come the ability to carry it out. I have to do the rest of the steps. And it is in that the grace starts to show up. I'll tell you one little story and then I'll... If Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new here, I could promise you something that I believe absolutely will be true in your life. That if you made this the center of your life and you made our primary purpose your primary purpose, and you started facilitating that by the cleaning house and seeking God, and you made A the center of your life, that there'll come a time when you will realize something that will be remarkable. that slowly, incrementally, over a period of time, Alcoholics Anonymous and the actions of AA have accessed something inside you that's come awake, that's very similar to the effects of alcohol when you first started drinking, when it set you free and it relieved you of the bondage of self. And all of a sudden, do you remember, remember in the early days of drinking? If you're like me, I could walk into a bar and I pretty much hated people. Just leave me alone. And after about four drinks, I start to love people. You know, I remember getting drunk with these guys and we'd say things to each other like, I love you, man. And really, no, it felt so amazing. I'd die for you, bro. Oh, my God. 2 hours before, I didn't even want to talk to him. You know, I was... But there was too much of me between me and him. And now we begin to have a spiritual experience that is very much like the effect of alcohol, except it's more, has more depth and more weight. And it's more substantial, but it is just as intermittent. When you drank alcohol, you always knew, didn't you, that this feels amazing. But you're going to have to get another bottle tomorrow. You're going to have to re-up tomorrow. You're going to have to re-up. Wouldn't it be nice to have a bottle that you drank from and you never had to re-up? You just get high and just be that way forever. But you got to re-up tomorrow. And we've got to re-up in the realm of the Spirit. Every day is the day I got to re-up here. I end with this story. My sponsor told it in 1980. I think it's the best. This is my favorite story. I didn't tell this. Did I tell the boat story? No, okay. Sometimes these weekends run together. In 1980, he said that when you hit a bottom, it's very much like being shipwrecked at sea. And there you are, hundreds of miles from land, totally alone. It's hard, and you're dying, and you know it. And you don't know if you're dying this day or you're going to be able to tread water for a couple days. You don't know, but you're dying. And it's frightening. And you're helpless and hopeless. And about the time where you're starting to wonder how much longer you can go, you're getting tired, you look up and you see this crazy thing. There's these two goofy looking guys. They kind of looks like, one of them looks like David and the other one looks like Graham. They're just goofy looking guys. And they're skimming across the water as if they're in a boat, but there's no boat there, and they're pretending they're rowing, and there's no oars, and they come right up to you, this invisible boat, and they say, my name's Graham, and my name's Dave. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous, and we have God in these beautiful 12 steps that will solve all your problems. And you go, get away from me. You guys are nuts. There's nothing there, man. There's God, 12 steps. There's nothing there. Just leave me alone. And they row off. About the time you're going to die, over the horizon comes this big chrome ocean liner. It says treatment center on the side. They got psychiatrists and psychologists and members of the opposite sex and medications and vocational rehabilitation specialists and biofeedback technicians and group therapy. Group therapy, 40 people in a room talking about me. And if you're like me, you suspect that a person of my depth and complexity would need all of that. Not those two idiots in that invisible boat. They don't got nothing for me, man. They're goofy guys. They don't even have any doctorate degrees, nothing. Goofy guys. So you get on board, and man, you're in group, you're watching the Father Mark movies, you're listening to the doctors talk about the brain chemistry, and you're pumping up, man, with information and a feeling like, man, I got it. This is great. I understand now. I get it. I'm good. 28 days later, over the side. And there you are with your $15,000 big book and your graduation chip, treading water. You watch that boat go out to sea. And there you are, totally alone. just about the time you're ready to go under, here come those two assholes in that visible light. And they come pretending like they're all, and they come right up to you. My name's Graham. My name's Dave. We're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got God and these beautiful 12 steps solve all your problems. And you go, oh, no. But you're weak. And you're tired. And they pull you on board. And there you are sitting on top of the water. You don't even know how you're sitting there. This is, it doesn't make any sense to you. As some of us will sit in an AA meeting at 10, 12 months sober, and we're sober longer and free from everything longer than we've ever been free since the day we first started getting high. And the truth is, I don't really know what's holding me up here. I can't see it. And you say, what do I do? And they say, row. Row? What do you mean there's not even any words? Oh, just go like this. Oh, no. No, come on, just go like this. And you start, you think, oh, I just hope nobody sees me. Oh, this is horrid. This is really horrid. And a funny thing happens. The more you row the boat, the more it materializes. And the more solid it becomes. It becomes so solid that you can have a life in that boat. You can raise a family in that boat. You can have a business in that boat. You can row around the world and pick up other drowning men and give them life. You can have freedom in the boat. You're safe and protected in the boat. And then what happens, unfortunately, because of the return of the alcoholic ego, is some of us get a sense of entitlement after years of being here. And we stop rowing the boat. And we don't know we stopped rowing the boat because we still go to meetings. We don't know that we stopped rowing the boat. And God starts to disappear. And the power starts disappearing. Oh, we still believe in God, all right. But we've gone from conscious contact, where the boat is substantial and real in our lives, to just an ethereal faith. It's only cognizant and not experiential. And there's a big difference between conscious contact and faith. You all get out of here this afternoon to go home. Whenever you're going to go home, you get in your cars and you drive down the road with absolute faith that there's cops and traffic laws. You may drive, they may affect your driving. You get a cop in your rear view mirror with these lights on, you've got conscious contact. And one has no depth and weight because it's of the mind, it's cognizant, it's intellectual. And the other one is experiential. And you stop rowing the boat, you don't have intermittent conscious contact anymore, because you're not in the you're not showing up in the proximity of the power. You're not helping others. And guys do this, and sometimes they will stay physically dry for decades, and then they get on medication and get addicted to pain pills, or they kill themselves, or they don't even know what's happening to them because they're still going to meetings. They don't even know. A couple months ago, I was just talking to an old timer. We started a new meeting in a rehab. And we're looking for guys that are sober a while. They asked us to bring people in that were sober over 20 years, if we could. So I went to this guy who was sober a long time. And I said, hey man, I want you to come. We're going to do some 12-step work. We're going to go down to this rehab. He said something to me that was frightening. It wasn't, and the frightening thing about it is it wasn't frightening to him, it was only frightening to me. He said, no, thanks. I've done a lot of that in my time. But not for a couple years. He stopped rowing the boat, and he looks depressed. Oh, he'll tell you, I'm doing great. I got a new car. And then you can watch it sink. The facade, the bravado sinks. In his heart where he lives, AA is not vital anymore. He has no enthusiasm for life, recovery, and helping others in the primary purpose. And enthusiasm comes from a Greek word, entheos, meaning the God within. His boat disappeared a long time ago. And he's still riding on the memory of it. The book warns us we cannot rest on our laurels. alcohol, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. It really is. We get seduced by the very success and fruits of our own recovery into a false sense of okayness. And then you stop rowing the boat and you want to coast. I bet you there's people in this room that are in trouble and you don't know you're in trouble. You want to know if you are or not? Check your actions. If you're half involved, you're involved in the actions of recovery, being sponsored, helping others, 12-step work, self-examination, prayer, meditation. If you're involved in those things at about half the level you were when you were a year or two sober, you're in trouble. You stop rowing the boat and you don't even know it because you're coasting. And the thing is, this disease is so insidious. When I talk to people who drink again after 20, 30 years of sobriety, a week before they drank again, they didn't think they'd ever drink again. Because the disease can't ambush you. It has to sneak up on you. And it sneaks up on you and it gets its opening by inaction. When you stop treating the spiritual malady, you start filling up with yourself. And I've been taking meetings down to this detox for 20, 30 some years now. And I interview people that drink again after years of sobriety. In every single case, you think, why do people drink again? Oh, they stop going to meetings. That is not true. I know people that went to 2 meetings one day and drank the same day. They stopped praying. That's not true. I watched a guy drink himself to death who was a member of the clergy. He was a priest who prayed more than most of us ever prayed. But there's one thing that always is consistent in those of us that drink again or commit suicide, is that their primary purpose shifted from helping others to helping themselves. Their main purpose in their life was no longer helping God's kids, it was helping themselves. They became their primary purpose. And they were full of themselves and they started to wither and die. And they didn't know it. They didn't know it. You can get a lot of relief here. And the relief just prolongs the inevitable. I don't want relief. I want freedom. Thanks for listening.
Hey, thanks everyone. We're going to pass the baskets at this point for voluntary donations. And also, this is the time when we're going to get the lunch ready, so please be patient. It'll take us about 15 minutes. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to put a bunch of tables out at the back. And we're going to put chairs, the chairs that you're currently sitting in, around the tables. And then you guys are going to form a line once the food's out and get your lunch. And we're going to start back at 1:30. And the lunch will be served about 12:30, and I'll make an announcement when it's time to eat. Okay, thank you.